You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hey, good evening, everybody. How great. You're like, there's so many in the audience. This is our third program, and I'm comforted to see you all here. And we're back at it. So I'm Jessica Strand. I'm the Director of Public Programs at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. We're also streaming this evening for those who couldn't make it down here. So I'm going to tell those people in the ether, if they want to ask questions after, they just type them into the chat. For those not familiar with the Library Foundation, LFLA is instrumental in supporting many of the programs at the Los Angeles Public Library, from homework help to college prep to Read Baby Read. The list is long, and the programs are vital in giving access and support to Angelenos across this vast city. Tonight, we're lucky enough to have two terrific novelists on our stage, Jennifer Egan and Danzy Senna, discussing Egan's new novel, The Candy House. To quickly synopsize or distill this novel into a few sentences is nearly impossible, so I will let our guests discuss this intriguing book, which contains a number of characters from the 2010 novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad. Suffice to say, Goon Squad dealt with music world, and The Candy House delves into the tech world, using it more closely, looking at more closely at memory and memories, and also, as one of the characters says so aptly, knowing everything is too much like knowing nothing. Without a story, it's just information. What's wonderful about Egan's work is that she's constantly experimenting with form and genre, never resting on a particular style, from modern Gothic to story cycle to historical novel. Her unpredictability keeps us on our toes and wanting more. Jennifer Egan is an author of several novels and a short story collection. Her 2017 novel, Manhattan Beach, a New York Times bestseller, was awarded the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction and was chosen by the New York City's One Book, One New York Read. Her previous novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad, won the 2011 Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and was recently named one of the best books of the decade by Time Magazine, Entertainment Weekly, and several others. As a journalist, she's written frequently for the New York Times Magazine. Danzy Senna is a novelist and essayist. She's the author of five books, including her first novel, Caucasia, and her most recent novel, New People. Her writing has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Vogue, and The New York Times. Please welcome Jennifer Egan and Danzy Senna.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. We're going to start with my doing a brief reading from the book and then having a chance to chat with my dear friend Danzy, which I don't get to do enough. So I'm happy that you all will be listening. And thank you so much to the Library Foundation and to all of you for coming out. It's amazing to actually be able to have live events. It's a joy. I feel extremely lucky. Writers have been hoping to do this for the last 2 years, and few have managed it. So I'm going to just read a couple of sections from the beginning of a chapter called The Mystery of Our Mother. One, long ago, she told us, when we were just a hope in her heart, or not even that, because she never wanted children, or thought she didn't, a higher power touched our mother's head and said, "Stop what you're doing. Two little girls are waiting to be born, and you need to have them right away, because the world is desperate for their brightness." So she stopped studying anthropology, which she really did love, and maybe would study again someday when you're all grown up and don't need me anymore. We'll always need you. I'll always need you too, that's for sure. I'll try not to drive you crazy with my mommy needs. Till the end. Well, I stopped going to anthropology school, and I married your daddy, and we brought you into the world. And here you are. It all worked out perfectly. Where is daddy? You'll see him next week. He's taking you to ballet. Last time he never came. I'll be here, just in case. He can't make a bun. That's not important, honey. Before ballet? Don't whine, sweetie. He threw Tam Tam out the window of the car. He said she was moth-eaten. That was unfortunate. How could you marry him? Love is a mystery. Does Daddy love you? He loves you. That's what matters. He said we were young spendthrifts. Did he now? He said, can we not talk about what he said? We're just telling you. I don't need to be told. I know your father very well. How did she endure these conversations? Of course our father didn't love her any more than she loved him. He was 15 years older than our mother, twice divorced when they met with four kids, two by each ex-wife. How's that for a rotten prospective husband? But he was charming, a famous record producer, and above all, we later surmised, he wouldn't take no for an answer. Why he wanted our mother to say yes is another mystery. They had nothing in common beyond a taste for beauty, his, and beauty, hers. But she never lived by her beauty. She was the kind of mom who rarely wore makeup, who let her hair grow wild and didn't bother to shower on Sunday, her day off from the travel agency where she went to work after our father stranded her without any money to raise us. Our parents' marriage collapsed when a San Francisco high school student washed up on their Malibu doorstep, having run away from home and hitchhiked south after our father seduced her on a business trip. We were 3 and 4 years old. Our father managed, on paper, to appear penniless. He left our mother with nothing but us, which, by his calculation, probably meant less than nothing. But for our mother, who had little else, we were infinite. She loved us infinitely in return and gave us that rare thing, a happy childhood. She never told us why she'd left our father. Much later, he did. On the occasions when our father showed up to take us to ballet, we walked grimly down the cracked outdoor steps from our second-story apartment to one of his many cars. Hello, girls. One of you want to ride in front? We shook our heads. It wasn't safe. Everyone knew that, except him. How about something to eat? We've got time before your class. We don't eat before ballet. I can't do anything right with you two, can I? We shook our heads, and he laughed and began to drive. But when he pulled up in front of the strip mall where the ballet studio was, he turned around and peered at us in the back seat. I'm your father. You understand that, don't you? We nodded in stony unison. That's not nothing. That means something. He searched our cold eyes. You don't like me. Why? It was not a rhetorical question. He was curious, awaiting a reply. We looked at our father closely for perhaps the first time. His weathered surfer's tan and longish blonde hair, his crooked front teeth. He watched us watch him, and then he laughed. How would you know? You're just two little kids. One day, after ballet, our father told us that we weren't going straight home. We glowered. Does mommy know? Of course your mother knows. What do you think I am, a kidnapper? He drove grimly, our lack of enthusiasm clearly needling him. We played rock, paper, scissors in the back seat and pretended he wasn't there. Hey, try looking around for a change. We were driving along a cliff, the ocean shivering enormously below. It seemed a different world from the parched, flat one we inhabited with our mother, full of glittering cars in broiling asphalt lots. Eventually, we descended the cliff and pulled into the driveway of a house with tiled roofs and magenta flowers overflowing its walls. There were no other houses around it. Rock and roll crashed from inside the house, but our father walked us straight past it to a beach whose fine white sand was different from Venice Beach, where our mother often took us on Sunday afternoons. Where are the people? It's a private beach. We're the only ones who can be here. Is it yours? Yes, it's mine. Go ahead, run around, have some fun. We stood watching him. Come on, play. When we failed to move, he said, I've never seen a pair of kids who wouldn't play. It's your beach. I'm your father. My beach is your beach. We like beaches with people. You're very rough, you two. Does your mother ever tell you that? We shook our heads. Ah, so I'm seeing the real you. The real you, plural. No, she is. She may think so, but I know better. Visibly heartened by this notion, he unbuttoned his Hawaiian shirt. Our father wore shorts year-round, day and night, but we'd never seen him bare-chested. It turned out that today, maybe always, his shorts were actually swim trunks. "Come on, kiddos," he said, taking our hands and trotting us over the powdery sand toward the sea. "We don't have bathing suits." "You're wearing leotards. That's the same thing." It was true. We each wore a sleeveless danskin with an elastic-waisted ballet skirt pulled over it and soft leather ballet slippers we'd gotten for Christmas. "Wait, we need to take off our skirts." He paused while we slid them off and folded them neatly on top of our ballet slippers, two little piles in the blinding white. "I like that, the way you take good care of your things." We stepped into the shimmering water with our father. The absence of a crowd, of music playing on boomboxes, of roller skaters and dogs and cigarette butts and popsicle sticks buried in the sand made it seem like an imaginary beach. We swam with our father. We were 7 and 8 years old, and we remembered that swim as the first nice time we ever had with him. Thank you. Wow.
Well, it's so wonderful to be with you here. And we first became friends when we were both in this sort of social experiment, a fellowship program of all writers that we were all sharing the same central office. And then we all had glass offices in a circle for a year, and we were all writing our books. And I was so struck. I remember when you presented your work to us, you were talking about how your inspiration for your fiction really doesn't come from the autobiographical and just sort of an idea that will preoccupy you. And I don't know if I'm getting it right, but I was really struck by that because it's seemingly so different from how I come to writing novels. But as I read your work, I sort of keep coming back to that thought and wondering, what was the idea you were chasing and what was the spark of it with this book, just for starters?
Well, it's usually a mix of ideas that are often really abstract, yeah, and then times and places that feel really vivid. Mm-hmm. And in this book, there were some sort of general guiding ideas, and then there were often kind of specific things I wanted to try in individual chapters. So the general guiding ideas, I mean, they really don't sound conducive to fiction because they're pretty abstract, but I was interested in exploring space and how our relationship to physical space is changing as a result of virtual experience.
Yeah.
You know, A Visit from the Goon Squad was very much about time, and I liked the thought of actually addressing space in a direct way also. I was really interested in the paradox whereby we are so data-driven and sort of data-oriented as a culture, and yet our data obviously is helpful and accurate, or it wouldn't be making companies like Facebook and Google so rich, but it also fails to explain us on an individual level completely. And we remain very mysterious creatures to each other, and perhaps even to ourselves. And data is so bad at predicting really major things. So I guess the relationship between data and interpretation, or data and storytelling, if you will, that's another kind of abstract idea that interested me. In terms of this particular chapter, there were a couple of things I was thinking about too. One was time and place very powerfully, you know.
Yeah.
It's funny though, I don't really know LA very well, so this is one of those occasions where I'm kind of pretending. But that feeling of the beach and this, you know, that this sort of sandy environment and a connection with a parent, I don't know, somehow that is really what was driving me. And then I very much wanted to write something in the first person plural. That was kind of on my list.
I love that.
So, and I had a lot of trial and error before I actually arrived. I had other family units I tried to do that with, and it didn't work.
There's a lot of fathers in father relationships that I feel like they are preoccupying some of the stories in here.
Mm-hmm.
But it was such an interesting reading experience because I felt such the pleasure of the traditional novel experience, but you had once again completely sort of reinvented the form. And I was so moved by the end of the novel, like you were pulling off this thing that I was like, don't try this at home, but Jenny Egan can pull this off. It's like a high wire act. And so I was just interested, like, because I've read some of your other novels that do kind of abide more by the kind of traditional novel structure. And then I felt like you had so mastered that you were able to do this other kind of inventive form where you're allowing these kind of different styles with each chapter, different characters. And I'm just wondering, is that sort of speaking to you now as a writer more and seem more in line with the way that we are living and our identities at this moment than the sort of like The Keep or some of your other novels that...
You know, it's interesting. I think that I like doing all of it, and I especially like doing something that's a contrast to what I've just done. So right. I can't imagine having... I did actually start this right after I finished A Visit from the Goon Squad, but I was mostly just kind of fooling around and gathering up material, wondering when I might actually use it and how. It was such a pleasure to do something very different. And in fact, I think that for me, writing the sort of traditional way, whatever that means, is actually a little harder. I found writing Manhattan Beach, a historical novel with a ton of research, just so difficult. And I think maybe because it took place outside of my lifetime, so I couldn't use times and places that I knew, which is really my main point of connection to what I'm doing. So, but I do think that, like, for example, when I started working on Manhattan Beach, I had the idea that I would use a lot of narrative, tricky narrative elements. I thought, well, I'm not going to just, like, set us in the past. I'm going to have fun with that and kind of call attention to it as a device and wink at the reader about it. And I thought, oh, that'll be so fun. You know, it'll be kind of like Goon Squad in the past. It was so unsuccessful that way. I mean, it was just, like, painfully unsuccessful, as my writing group very sternly told me, one of whose members is here, I think, my friend Lisa Fugard, whom I owe a great deal, and who's an incredible writer also. Anyway, it was very clear that these narrative tricks were not suited to that material, and in fact, it was a relief to let them go and tell the story in a more direct way and just let the reader, you know, be in the past. It's not like the reader's going to lose their way and go into a fugue state because I'm not reminding them that, in fact, it's actually the 21st century. So, like, let's just have that experience. But what I ended up feeling was that one reason that those tricks, fragmentation, irony, some of that felt so ill-suited to that material may have been technological, which actually connects to the point you were just making. You know, it was the last era before the small screen, and somehow those techniques feel more at home for me in a story that's about life in our current media environment. And I'm not sure exactly why that is, but it may be that in the end I would love to write more historical novels. I really enjoyed it. And it may be that I can find a way to be more inventive in that realm, which may give the lie to everything I'm saying, but it did strike me that, you know, fragmentation and a certain amount of disorientation, achronology, of that feels more akin to a kind of internet environment that we're all very used to inhabiting now.
Right. And I don't know how many people have read this novel, but you may want to tell them a bit about the concept and the sort of thread that runs through it. But I am really interested because we're both Gen Xers, and I feel like we're kind of, you know, the last generation to kind of come of age without that other screen defining our identity. And one of the things that happened to me, you know, years ago, like I started noticing that I was hanging out with younger friends and even friends my age. And I remember there was a moment when I was like playing with a finger puppet in a shop with a friend, and they said, oh, let me take a photo. And I didn't realize that if your friend takes your photo, then that's just going onto the internet. And it was like the first time like my old Gen X ass was like, what? Wait, that's going up on Instagram, that silly moment, and every moment that you're being photographed is the moment that is there to share and to kind of, and it really, I just kept thinking about that as I was reading this novel, and I mean, it was just such a heady experience reading this and thinking of you writing it over the last few years, and it's sort of science fiction and sort of actually realism, this novel, what you're doing here. So I don't know, just...
Well, so a couple of things. So one thing is I'm older than you are. I'm actually technically a baby boomer.
Oh, you
which
are.
Which is unbelievable, I know. I'm kind of glad about it now. I feel like, wow, I actually can span even to the baby boomers. I'm a young baby boomer. But yes, I mean, I feel like I came of age without having experienced any technological telecommunications innovations that I was aware of other than call waiting. And that was actually huge because without call waiting, we had to get a second line when I became a teenager so that I wouldn't, you know, so that someone else could actually use the telephone in the house and receive a phone call. So, you know, each one of those innovations seemed enormous, but there basically were very few. Wait, I'm so sorry. Remind me of where I'm going with this.
I was talking about just, you know, my millennial friends taking my photo and then the science fiction realism aspect.
Yeah, so that leads perfectly, and I will just briefly explain what the kind of innovation at the heart of this is, which, by the way, I didn't come up with until pretty late in the process.
Oh, really?
I knew there would be an invention that would be important, but I wasn't sure what it was. The invention, and by the way, this is not original. Apparently, a Black Mirror episode involves something like this. I knew that anyway. But anyway, the idea is that a guy named Bix Boughton invents something called Own Your Unconscious, which allows you to externalize your consciousness in full onto a cube for your own use. And there are many uses. You can look at moments of childhood from an adult perspective. You can identify people that you want to identify. You can reinfuse that whole consciousness should you have a traumatic brain injury or dementia. So there are lots of reasons to do this. And there's also a possibility, which is that you can share your consciousness all or in part to the collective consciousness, which gives you access to the anonymous consciousnesses of everyone else who has done the same. And it feels familiar, but for exactly the reason you're saying, because even if you choose not to directly participate in this, you are represented in it by all the people who have. So your friend, you know, photographing you with the finger puppet would be the equivalent of someone who was present that day sharing their consciousness and the whole experience of you with the finger puppet being represented. And so there are people who abhor this representation. They don't want to be in the collective consciousness and they don't have a choice because too many people near them are sharing. So a kind of resistance develops of people called the eluders who cast off their identities altogether.
I'm getting a t-shirt that says eluder. Like it's my favorite way to identify myself now.
Well, it's in a way, it's sort of appealing, kind of. I mean, obviously, all of this is sort of a thought experiment, but their feeling is it's not even worth being me anymore. That this identity feels too exhausted, too known. I'm sick of it. So they cast off their identity and begin again as someone else. But you can't just disappear from the internet without everyone noticing. Yeah. So they hire what are known as proxies to impersonate them online so that only people who would have expected to see them in person actually know that they're gone. And proxies can range from, at the cheap end of the spectrum, a program that just uses whatever utterances it can gather to spew out, you know, dialogue that sounds like you or whatever else. Or you can actually have a human being serve as your proxy. And I enjoyed positing that fiction writers, for example, would be kind of good at doing that.
Yeah.
So that's basically the landscape, the technological landscape that I'm imagining. But in a way, the fun of it really was just imagining people, all of the drama that could evolve from that, people using the device, what they would use it for, and those experiences.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the rest of it, escaping, who helps people escape, why do they do it, all of that.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm so, it felt like in some ways this novel was also writing about being a writer and being a fiction writer. There was some other subtext here to how we, as fiction writers, edit and shape reality and memory and the sort of, I'm teaching a class right now on autofiction, and so this really fit in, like I would teach this as a way of thinking of sort of memory and the act of editing your own life to create a narrative, and sort of changing yourself in order to kind of find that fictional freedom. And so I was thinking about all these ideas while I was teaching, and then I read this book and I was like, this is exactly kind of getting at some of these ideas. There's a New Yorker cartoon that's a man sitting in a chair on the computer and his wife's in a negligee behind him tapping his shoulder, and he says, I'm coming to bed soon as I finish the internet. And the idea that, like, as fiction writers, we're finding what to leave out of this reality and this memory bank, and we're constructing a whole reality as a way of getting to another kind of truth. And this book seemed to, like, really keep coming back to that idea of story and of, you know, the fact of information not being the story, information being something endless. So I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I do feel like, in a way, it is a book about writing fiction for another reason, too, which is, as I said, I didn't know what this invention would be that this character would make. I knew it would be important, but it was only as I worked on individual chapters, many of which take place in the future, and started to get glimmers of things that people could do in this imagined future and things that I wanted to do narratively. So, for example, I thought, I'd love to write a story or a chapter in which people can just see someone that they've glimpsed once in their lives. Like, they can actually track them down and find out who they were, who they are, how they live, you know, what's happened to them. And that was driven by my own curiosity to do such a thing. You know, I sometimes think about people that I just saw years ago, and I think, who
like
were they?
Like on an airplane or something?
On
like
an airplane, walking down the street in
right,
New York.
Right.
Just these kind of glancing encounters that, for whatever reason, have stayed with me. But, you know, even with all the ease of tracking people down nowadays, I don't have enough identifying information to do that. But what if I could do a facial recognition search? So thinking that way is really what led me to it. Actual things that I wanted to do. Another idea was, I was really interested in something I was thinking of as a kind of invasive omniscience, like omniscience that is just so deep that we really know everything. I mean, stream of consciousness in a way is like that. But I love the idea of going deep inside one person and then really as deeply inside another. That's also called the third person point of view.
Right.
So in a certain way, I feel like I was inventing a machine that could explain all the things I felt like doing narratively and make it easy for me not to have to come up with some sort of logic system in which people can identify people they've seen just once in their lives. And so it was fun to find a way in this book to actually have someone use Own Your Unconscious, or specifically the product is, hey, whatever happened to ... And this is a guy who's recovering from a drug problem, who keeps thinking about the guy that he was buying drugs from when he was using and wants to know what happened to this guy. And so he ends up attaching electrodes to his head and remembering Damon, this drug dealer, very intensely, at which point those memories are released to the collective. And then facial recognition tracks down other memories from other people in which that same face appears. So he ends up being able to essentially watch Damon's life story from anonymous viewpoints, starting when the guy is a kid and concluding when he's in Orange in a penitentiary. My protagonist is incredibly disappointed. He had somehow hoped that Damon would have accomplished great things, but in fact learns that he didn't. So this was just very convenient. I mean, there's no other way to put it. This device was a device for me. Right. And it was driven a lot by narrative wishes.
But then, of course, yeah, and the book does feel like we're doing exactly that, of course. So it has this other meta meaning. But it feels like I was saying, you know, just like a sliver away from reality, because, of course, we all go and stalk people online and look up somebody we knew in high school and start to find out, you know, we can do a lot of this stuff already. And the book seemed to me like it was going to feel dystopian, and then it didn't. And by the end, I didn't feel as hopeless as I thought I was going to. And I'm just curious, because I'm an eluder, I tend to have these very sort of like, you know, negative feelings about technology and about my children and their brains and what's happening to all of us. But I'm wondering, like, it didn't feel like you were as hopeless as I would have imagined myself to feel. Like, I avoided this completely by writing my last novel in the 90s so that I could have someone stalk someone in real time without a cell phone. And you went right into the sort of present and the future, and I felt like there was some humanity intact by the end of this book, even despite all of this vision that you had of where we're going that felt very realistic.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. One thing I love about writing fiction is that I find out what I actually think right. by doing it. And I've repeatedly had the thought that something was going to be, you know, the question that I'm asking suggests a kind of negative outcome. So, for example, with my novel, Look at Me, I was explicitly asking myself, whether image culture has changed who we are to ourselves. Has it sort of encroached on deep private life? And the very fact that I would ask that question suggests that I kind of thought the answer was yes, but the book actually comes to the opposite conclusion. And I think the same was true here. You know, I never thought of the device as dystopian. Again, I was driven to it by my own curiosity about ways that it could be used, both in narrative and in life. You know, I think I'd be the first to want to externalize my consciousness. Like, I think it's kind of a great idea. So I guess what I realized that I thought as a result of writing, or I realized that what I think as the result of writing this book, and I'm so glad to have discovered this, because I do share many of your worries as a parent, as an inhabitant of planet Earth. I mean, I'm full of worries and dread, but what I ended up feeling was I have an enormous faith in people. Hmm. I really do. I have a lot of faith in humanity and in our ability to innovate and solve problems. There's a lot that works against us, there's no question, and we can absolutely be our own worst enemies, and I think we need to work together more than we do, and technology, I think, sometimes really discourages that, but I just have a lot of faith. So I guess the answer is it turns out I really am an optimist. and maybe too, that's just what I needed as I was working on this book, which I ended up working on, you know, certainly before the pandemic, but a lot in the Trump years and certainly during the pandemic, when maybe being negative and finding a bleak outlook, or just inhabiting a bleak outlook, almost felt repetitive to me. Mm. You know, it felt too much like what reality was. And for me, fiction is an escape. I'm the opposite of an auto-fictionalist. I mean, if I get a whiff of my life coming in, I feel dead and bored. I've got to get away. So I have to go somewhere where I'm not. And somehow in the course of writing it, I feel like I became more optimistic. So I'm kind of grateful for that.
Yeah, and I was grateful for it too, because it was, you know, it's a source of great anxiety for me. The encroachment of the sort of collective consciousness and the fact that we can know everything about everyone. Like, I don't want to know, often when I'm reading a novel, I don't want to know what the author had for breakfast and what they're thinking from minute to minute. And I find that, like, this breaking the fourth wall is sort of disruptive to my fictional experience. And so I was actually, like, it sort of shook some of my feelings in a good way too. Like I came away from it a little bit surprised at my feeling less kind of binary about the whole thing. But I was wondering, you know, because it's, you've called it a sibling to the Goon Squad, and I love that as a term. And I was thinking, you know, and then you also say you don't want to write autofiction, which I really appreciate. And I was wondering, though, you know, are all of your books in some ways siblings? And are there kind of obsessions that you feel yourself keep returning to, and do you know what the source of those obsessions
are? That's a great question. I mean, I think certainly technology, there seems to always be technology, yeah. even in a book like Manhattan Beach, yeah. where there's no screen technology, but there's so much other technology, and I don't even know why I was so obsessed with the equipment of deep sea divers. Yeah. You know, too much,
that's
according
to some
readers.
That's what you're writing readers. At the library, too, right?
I got the idea for it there, yes. But for some reason, technology always seems to fascinate me, which is odd because, again, as a sort of civilian, I that's not the case at all. I'm a late adopter, an incompetent adopter. I wait till the thing breaks before I get another one because I know it'll take me a while to figure it all out. So I don't know why it is that technology seems to be a fixation, but certainly mass media and its evolution and the ways in which that interacts with our lives is a huge focus. And I think that comes very much just from, as I said, my own background and the sense that it feels like that's one of the big stories I've witnessed in American life.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of it. And then there are certain themes that do come up, and then there is certainly an autobiographical element to those. Their fathers are everywhere. I didn't get to know my father well. And I think I feel the lack of that. And so I keep, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm writing about absent fathers and I think, oh, that's so boring. Stop doing that. But then I seem to be getting very involved in father-daughter relationships. So you know, I mean, the family structure, even though I don't think of myself as writing about family very much explicitly, you know, that is what we all start with, whatever it may consist of. And so I think that does come through. And another, you know, thing that appears a lot is, you know, brother-sister relationships. Yeah. I had a brother I was very fond of, and he was a very fragile person who had mental illness. And so, you know, that, but it's never direct.
It comes sideways and slant, and that makes it more, I think, alive as fiction, that you're not kind of coming at it directly.
I mean, but I will say this, autofiction reads the same way. You know, we can't tell. The reader just wants to be taken somewhere that feels alive. Yeah. And so I hand it to someone who can do that through using their own lives. It's certainly I can't do it. So I think wherever the heat is kind of where we're all going to you know, write something that just feels rich and alive.
Yeah.
But I do see some of these through lines in my work, and I think my wish to avoid repeating myself is so strong that is another reason I really like using unusual forms, because if I can make an unusual form work, what that means, and there's so much trial and error involved in this, but it means that I've somehow landed on a story that can only be told that way, because it just, if you're writing a story that could be told conventionally, let's say, which is a vexed term, but it's not going to work in PowerPoint. It's not going to work in 140 character utterances for Twitter
or email.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But if I can find something that does feel alive in those forms, I'm telling a story that I couldn't have told otherwise. And that's really exciting. So that's one reason I do this. There's a lot of frustration involved and a lot of waiting. But when I can make it work, I feel like, oh, that's great. I sort of got outside of my path of least resistance and I did something different.
Yeah. And you're finding stories everywhere, which I love. You know, that we don't think of an email thread as a story, but that's, the most hilarious chapter in this book, and it's just emails.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, though, you know, the earliest novels were often epistolary, yeah, so right. that goes way back, and I've wanted to do that for a long time. So that was yeah. I was very happy to finally find a way to use that.
That was so much fun.
It was pretty fun to do that.
Yeah. and this is just, I'll let other people ask questions, but I had one more thing I was interested in just selfishly, that you're juggling so many different elements in your life. Like, we aren't childless 21-year-olds, you know, staying up all night writing our novel, but we're juggling real full lives. And then on top of that, you've written this novel through sort of all this cataclysmic change and that sort of news cycle being so much of a sort of assault on that dream state that we want to be in as novelists. And so I was just wondering sort of, you know, how you've sustained your focus and kind of faith in the novel form in this time that we're living in.
Well, I think one advantage that I have is because I'm not writing about myself, not knowingly, there's a kind of detachment always of what I'm doing from the context in which I am. And I like that separation. Right. So in a way, that protects me a little bit from the vicissitudes of political life, daily life, all of it. You know, I feel like if I can do the thing I'm trying to do, I actually am apart from all of that. And if the project has its own center of gravity, which doesn't happen right away, but if I'm further along and it's really sort of taking shape, it can be an incredible distraction, a really welcome haven, honestly, right. from events. There are times when my sense of peril is so strong that I just feel like I keep staring at my phone thinking I'm going to get important news. But I do find, you know, and this is sort of back to faith in human beings, and the sense of, you know, how do we get away from some of this technology? We're so trainable. I mean, if we've learned anything in the last 2 years, it's how relatively easily we can adjust our habits. And I find that, you know, so I turn off the notifications, or I don't have any technological devices near where I'm working. Guess what? Within like 15 minutes, that repeated wish to check is gone. So I try to train myself and retrain myself. It's an ongoing process. The other thing I will say is I don't have little kids at home. I now have an empty nest as of the fall, but up until then, I often felt that I was getting nothing done. Yeah. It really felt like that all the time. But I found that I was doing more than I gave myself credit for or could even really perceive sometimes. Yeah. And it's amazing how even in a situation that feels chaotic, just putting in some regular time does add up. You know, I think of Graham Greene, who apparently wrote a perfect page every day, which resulted in a novel a year. I mean, a page a day, that seems so little, but if it's good and you can just keep going, I mean, and he was drinking by noon.
Yeah.
I mean, if he could do that, you know, come on.
I remember at the library, you had children in elementary school, or
I had a 1 and a 3-year-old.
Oh my God. Because the rest of us were being so unproductive, and you would come in and work and then, you know, put in that perfect page and then leave. And we were like sitting around chatting, going to yoga, let's start drinking at 4. And we were the ones with all the time in the world, but your constraint made you much more productive.
Well, I definitely had a pillow in my desk drawer, and I would close the shutters in my office and like put it on my desk. Yeah. But I mean, I think that's the other thing, you know, having a full life does sometimes force you to use the time you have. So
yeah. Well, I want to make sure people have time to ask their questions, so I'll open it up.
Feel free to shout it out if
you
want. I'm sure we'll hear you. Yes.
A little bit of, hello. I didn't think I was going to get the first question, but I'm ready. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the sort of good and bad parts of being this Pulitzer Prize winning author, like that label, and how that changed your life for the good and bad and everything that comes with, you know, putting it on your books and all that type of thing.
Well, I mean, there's no question, you know, we are a brand-oriented culture. So having a brand like that on your books and name is unbelievably helpful and useful in very practical ways, like finding new readers, and you know, and getting reviewed. I mean, things that I absolutely did not ever take for granted. And so I couldn't be more grateful. Also, having judged prizes and also having been kicking around for quite a while before I had that good luck, I understand very clearly that it is good luck. You know, winning a prize feels very, it looks so iconic from the outside, but in fact, it just means that you managed to please the right handful of people that year, or maybe you were the compromise candidate, but you were the only one they could agree on. I mean, that really is how these things work, but all of that messiness kind of disappears once the thing has been bestowed. So I feel aware of all of that and so happy for that luck. On the other
side... But you're very humble. The book is great. You're a great writer, so I just want to say
but
it's not just luck.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do know what you're saying.
Thank you, and I'm proud of that book. But I will just say, again, that, you know, there are a lot of good books. Luck is a funny thing. You know, it's something extra. Deserving is not enough, oddly. You need a lot more than that. And I felt very aware of that. So the negative side of everything I'm saying and my awareness of all of that was that I felt really overvalued. And I felt like a huge correction was going to come my way. And that made it really hard to work on the next book, which was really a hard process. It was also just happened to be, as I said earlier, kind of cutting myself off from the thing that I most need, which are times and places that I know. So the result of all that was that I was pretty freaked out for about 2 years of work. And I really felt like maybe it was just over for me. Like that was kind of it. And then I ended up saying to myself, you know, if that's true, you know, if winning this prize actually is going to result in my never doing anything better than that, then I was probably done. And so, okay, you know, great. Luckily, I got a prize before I kind of threw in the towel.
You're like, Wikipedia page done.
So, and in a way, I guess I just felt like I had to give myself permission to not get better, which is always the goal. And the danger, I feel, another thing I feel really grateful for is that my good luck came later in my career, because the goal is always to keep getting better. And I think for me, anyway, that would have been really hard to do if I had felt so much pressure as a really young writer. I began very slowly, and everything was pretty incremental up until that point. And so I guess I had enough tools to help me through that. But I'm not sure I just would have had the inner compass to find my way toward getting better if I had been over-rewarded too early. So those are some thoughts about that.
Yeah.
Yes. That's an interesting. Did everyone hear that? I was playing with Jung in naming this collective, the collective consciousness. It's a different notion from his, but his is really interesting to me and something that I think about a lot in my writing, because his idea was that there is actually a collective body of knowledge that we partake of that includes, I'm really sort of reaching back now to like college courses, but myths, you know, there's a sort of a deep well of knowledge that we as humans share. I think that's probably a vexed notion now in certain ways, because I think we're more aware than ever of the different cultural realms we come from, and the idea of there being sort of one pool it seems potentially more problematic. But putting all of that aside, my writing method is completely geared toward accessing forces, knowledge, and just cultural assumptions, that my context beyond what I could consciously implement. So I'm looking to have the moment around me with all of its complexities and nuances and cultural assumptions, touchstones, shared history. I want all of that to act through me, because that is where the interesting stuff lives, far more than in my conscious mind, which is probably more likely to go in directions that other people's in this room would. You know, I think there is a kind of a surface level at which we are thinking sometimes in similar ways, and I'm looking to kind of get beyond all of that, and certainly looking to get beyond my critical tendencies, which are likely to be telling me, that's no good, I don't like that sentence, you know, back up, start over. My method is all about hurtling forward, writing by hand, and thereby hopefully surprising myself. And the very fact that I can be surprised suggests that I'm trying to bring to bear more knowledge, more consciousness than I have in my immediate thoughts. Interesting.
I want to make sure other people get a chance to ask questions, because we only have 5 minutes. Yeah.
I'm not aware of that work, but I am very interested in the relationship between fiction writing and dreaming. Mm-hmm. But there is a joke in this book, which is that there's a couple who, in their marriage vows, was an agreement never to make each other listen to their dreams.
I love that.
Because let's face it, people's dreams are so boring to everyone but themselves.
So true, yes.
You had a question.
Having a continuation in this new book with some of the characters from Goon Squad, did you have any like apprehension or anxiety about revisiting some of these characters, especially characters that were, pretty beloved from a pretty beloved book? Was there any sort of thoughts about that? Had you done that before?
You know, the characters that I revisit are pretty minor in Goon Squad, with the exception of Lou, the father in What I Read to You. He's the only one that we really see at any length in Goon Squad that we also see from multiple angles this time. Other than that, they're mostly so minor that readers, unless someone has read the book recently, which, by the way, there is no need to do before reading The Candy House, and I did not myself, and made a lot of factual errors I had to correct when I did finally reread it. It was really what piqued my curiosity about certain characters was precisely the fact that we know them so little. So I didn't worry too much that a beloved character would be changed. With a couple of exceptions, because point of view gets a little crazy in this book, because I have people looking through other people's consciousnesses, so whose point of view are we looking at exactly? It's sort of more than one at a time. But in general, I'm not inside the same points of view of the major characters in Goon Squad. So I had many worries. I'm a worrier. I worried that the book would be perceived as less than and not up to a beloved book, but I didn't specifically worry about the characters. Yes, I'm back. Oh, okay. There and then there.
I've got the mic. I would really love to hear you talk a bit about what the novel does for you, because one of the things I find so interesting about your writing, what everybody finds interesting about your writing, is your exploration of all these multiple forms. This came out in the conversation this evening, and yet you keep writing novels, which are pretty traditional forms. So,
well, I see the novel as being the most versatile form, actually, and I would include anything image-based in that judgment. I think we're very inclined toward images, and that becomes more and more the case. But anything that is starting with an image is putting us on the outside of the person whose mind we are hoping to penetrate. To me, fiction is the one narrative art form that actually puts us on the inside. And the fact that there are no images is a critical part of that. We have to make the images. We use language in our brains to do something that feels like it actually solves one of the big barriers of human life, which is that we are completely isolated inside our own minds, and nothing can change that. You can surf the internet for as long as you want and find out, you know, all about what happened to whoever, but it doesn't really change that fact. So that, to me, is what fiction does and why it matters. And the funny thing is, to me, the novel was invented to be a kind of eclectic grab bag. And from the very start, novels were pulling every other kind of discourse into themselves, whether it was legal documents, letters. Tristram Shandy, a very early novel, has graphic elements in it. There's a black page. So to me, that gives me license to... When I do what seem to be extreme things, I see that as the most traditional use of the novel form, actually.
I love that.
It is, unlike epic poetry, which I think couldn't do some of this, it is invented to be a flexible, elastic, hungry invader of human minds. And that's what
so
I like.
I love that.
We have one last question back here.
And I'm just going to add that I'm happy to keep these conversations going in the signing line. I'm sorry to cut anyone off without them having a chance to talk.
Well, my last name is Egan, too. So I wonder if there's maybe a connection there. If we upload our unconsciousness, we might find, I don't know, a distant relative. But my question's actually about time. And in Goon Squad and in The Candy House, obviously you bounce around a lot in time, but both works, at least for me, are very future-facing. And so I think in Candy House, you write into the 2030s, which isn't that far away. And I just have a question about kind of the affordances and the challenges of writing into the future.
Great question. I would never do it if I didn't have to. I've been thrust into the future because if I want to visit people who are clearly born at certain times later in their lives, I don't have a choice. With Goon Squad, where the future was actually 2020, I was dragged there kicking and screaming, and I so much didn't want to go there, but I wanted to visit my character, Alex, at a later point in his life, that I briefly considered moving the entire timeline of the book back like 10 years, which would have had people remembering Elvis. I mean, it was crazy. Like, there was no way to do it. I really didn't want to do it. So, and that's because I don't really feel qualified. I'm not that conversant in sci-fi. I don't even feel a deep interest in it as a genre. I'm sorry to say that, and I hope it doesn't offend anyone. And therefore, inventions and ideas that I have, I know will not really be useful entrance into that field, because that never is the case if you're not really well-versed in what you're doing. So all of that makes me not want to do it. But that being said, there are some big advantages to writing in the future, number one of which is that you can make up anything you want. I mean, of course, I can do that anyway, but it becomes an invitation to think forward and posit easy solutions to logistical problems. As one example, there's a chapter in here about a woman who is working as a spy in 2032 and trying to gather information about men who are believed to be plotting against America. And so, she needs to record them. She wants to actually create a record of what they're saying and doing. And I remember in the moment thinking, okay, but how can she do that? How does she have a tape recorder with her? And the minute I had that thought, I realized, she has a recorder implanted in her. She has a camera implanted in her. Of course, I could posit that in present day, in a present day narrative, and for all I know, this may actually already happen. but it was sort of a gleeful possibility that writing into the future made available to me. So I've come to enjoy it, but I never expect to be making a contribution to the field in terms of invention. And that's why it was no surprise that, you know, Black Mirror and maybe this Vendors movie, these ideas are not new. The fun of it was actually exploring them narratively and seeing what would happen in people's lives in response to all of it. Thank you so much.
Thank you both. Thanks a lot. Thank you all for being here. Come next Tuesday, we have Sarah Schulman. And then at the Oritani, we have John Waters the Tuesday after that. Thank you all. Thanks. Good night.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.